I want to continue this morning talking about how to renew marriage. We started this a couple of Sundays ago, and we talked about God's orderly structure of the family, how the husband and wife, the parents become the head of the house, and that the father, the husband in the house, is the head of even that unit, but that they should work together in harmony and consensus, etc. And that what happens is, you've got the honeymoon, phase one of the marriage, where everybody is just getting along great. And then, during phase two, you start working through this order of the family. You get sort of squashed together in close proximity for years, and it starts wearing on everybody, and you start working through the structure of the family, and who's the head, and how you do things, and how you discipline. And that's what I call phase two, and that's the place where most marriages are their rockiest. And that's anywhere from year one to year 15 in the marriage, somewhere in there that starts happening. And then the third phase of the marriage is the life as you wish it had been all along phase. It's a place where you can start enjoying being married and enjoy each other and things like that. What I want to do is talk about some of the obstacles that we run into during phase two in our marriage. And I want to talk about some ways that we can kind of get over some of those obstacles. There are probably a dozen different things we could talk about. I want to cover three of them in a little bit more detail. One is hostilities and resentments begin to build up between each other, and we got to have a way to get rid of that. And that's primarily what we'll be talking about this morning, and then hopefully next Sunday we'll talk about the immaturity that you bring into your marriage, both the husband and the wife, and how that's an obstacle to your marriage. And then we're going to talk also about the loss of life as you knew it. And I know that may not make sense now, but you have lost what life you had before, and we'll talk about how to deal with that, because it causes problems. Let's talk about how to get through the built-up hostilities and the resentments that just happen when two people live closely together for years in marriage. We're like little batteries. We hold a charge, and unfortunately, it's a negative charge. And it works like this. Every time your spouse disrespects you, you store a little bit of a negative charge. And every time that they're selfish, instead of showing you love, well, you store a little bit more negative charge. And then whenever they accuse you of being inadequate somehow in the marriage, you just store up a little bit more negative charge. They forget your birthday. They forget your anniversary. They forget how you like your coffee. They don't say, I love you before they leave the house. Any number of things. And you store this little negative charge and this resentment, and all these things keep building up until pretty soon you become just like the Energizer Bunny, both of you, and all you can do is just keep going and going and going, spewing out this resentment that's been built up, and hurting each other, and saying nasty things to each other. Unfortunately, you discharge your battery by attacking your spouse, and all of a sudden all that venom begins to flow out, and it flows out to the person you love the most. What a shame. And so I want to give you some hints on how to deal with that this morning. It's human nature to act this way, okay? Unfortunately, it'll tear apart your marriage, but it's still human nature. But you know what? For those of you that have new babies, babies are born completely selfish, aren't they? I mean, they are ruthless in getting their own way. That's our human nature. And so we spend years and tears training that out of them and training them how not to be selfish and how to share and how, you know. Same thing with our human nature about storing up resentments. We're going to have to train ourselves out of that if we want to have a good marriage. There was a fad in psychology years and years ago, and the idea was if you get angry, what you need to do is you need to somehow express that anger, and after you express it, then you'll feel better. And so the idea was you need to take some old dishes and break the dishes, or you need to go out and stand in the yard and just scream at the top of your lungs. I mean, do something to get the anger out. And they discovered that that really didn't work very well. I mean, it kind of worked for the instant, but that kind of outlet wasn't what we needed. I mean, now sometimes we do need an outlet for our anger and resentment that begins to build up. You know, there's nothing like a good game of racquetball or tennis where you're hitting something, or jogging maybe. Or Sandy was talking about women that make bread, you know, they can knead that bread and they really work. Or you can even massage your spouse and boy, you really get down in there and, you know, kind of hurt them, make it feel good. But that kind of getting the anger out never really works. The only safe way to deal with pent-up resentment and anger is to leave the drain of your heart open so that it never builds up in the first place. In other words, don't let it build up inside of you, and you won't have to worry about it coming out. Now, let's talk about that some. Most folks' first thought is, yeah, how can you do that? Well, you don't take the wrongs in the first place. In other words, you don't take in the hurts. You don't take it personally when your spouse hurts you. If you don't store up the charge in the battery in the first place, then you're not going to have anything to discharge when the battery gets connected up. You see what I'm saying? Folks are saying, Father Dan, that's a lot harder to do than you think. You just can't do that. It's impossible. Yeah. Let me tell you, it's not impossible. It's a choice. And I want to prove it to you. Imagine you're with your four-year-old, you're going to Ben and Jerry's, and right about the time you get to the door, they push in front of you, and they open the door, and they run in, and they get in line first so they can get an ice cream first. I mean, this is the way four-year-olds are, right? Now, what's your reaction to your four-year-old when they do that? Do you get angry with them for doing that? Why, no. Well, I mean, you may use it as a teachable moment, you know, about how to be polite and how to act socially correctly and all that kind of stuff, but you don't get mad at them. Do you resent them for trying to be first? Do you condemn them for their immaturity and wanting to push ahead of you? They might do that with your spouse, but do you do that with your four-year-old? Do you nurse a grudge because they didn't love you enough to defer to you? Do you think that they're somehow trying to hurt you in getting ahead of you? Huh? No. But your spouse, now that's different, because they ought to know better. They ought to be more mature, right?
Yeah.
And you know what? Maybe they should be more mature. Maybe they do know better. But they don't. Listen, whether or not you take in the offense is a choice on your part. It's a choice that you are free to make or not make. And you prove that when you choose to not take offense at your four-year-old, even though they may deserve it. You can choose not to be offended at what your spouse does because that's the way God works with us. Turn to Psalm 130, verse 3. Now, there are lots of scriptures that say this exact concept, and I just want to read one or two of them to you. Psalm 130. Psalm 130 says, if you, Lord, should mark iniquities, you know, like you would mark in a little book, keep up with, keep score, that sort of thing. Anybody ever kept score in their marriage? Well, I washed the dishes last night. Here's your turn. If you, Lord, would mark iniquities, then who, O Lord, would stand? You see, the implication is God isn't marking our iniquities against us. Well, we know that the devil is the accuser of the brothers. It's the devil that's keeping track of all the bad things we do. It's not God. Look at Isaiah 43:25. I am the one who wipes out your transgressions for my own sake. In other words, because I want to. And I will not remember your sins. This is God talking. See, this is how God is. He doesn't take into account the wrong suffered in the first place, and then he doesn't remember the things that we do wrong. You say, I choose not to take offense at my four-year-old because they don't know any better. But my spouse, they ought to know better. Well, let's turn that back with God and see how God works with this stuff. When God doesn't mark your iniquities against you, did you know better? When you sin, do you know better? Well, of course we know better. When we do what's wrong in God's eyes and when we treat each other in awful ways, of course we know better. But what does God do? He ignores it. He's not marking it down. He's not keeping track of our iniquities or our mistakes. It's the devil that does that, and who do you want to be like? You want to be like God, or do you want to be like the devil? Matter of fact, who do you think would be better at renewing a marriage? God or the devil? So you see, if your marriage needs to be renewed, then you need to act like God does. Turn to 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter. 1 Corinthians 13. Let's see how God defines true love. God is love, right? The essence of love is God, vice versa. Paul in 1 Corinthians 13 is describing what true love is. True love is patient, it's kind, he's not jealous, does not brag, it's not arrogant. And he goes on down here and look at the bottom half of verse 5, and he says, in my translation it says, love does not take into account a wrong suffered. Now, there are other translations that say some different things. What does this one say?
It's not irritable or resentful.
Yeah, it says it's not irritable or resentful. The literal translation there is that love does not keep an inventory of injuries or of mistakes or wrongs suffered. True love doesn't keep account of what's been done wrong to them. And notice, this has nothing to do with your spouse. This is all about you and whether or not you're going to walk in true godly love. Doesn't have anything to do with how the other person treats you, what they do or don't do. The question is, are you going to walk in love and not take into account a wrong suffered? The only way that you can eventually get out from under the hostilities and resentments that build up during phase two of the marriage is to break the cycle and stop charging the battery in the first place. And if you don't do that, you could be in for a long, tumultuous period. And so what you got to do is don't take into account the way your spouse wrongs you. Now, the second suggestion for getting out from under resentment and hostility in the marriage is say good things about your spouse. Or maybe I should just say talk. The more you communicate in a marriage, the better it's going to be. Now, I know that during phase two, you don't want to talk because y'all are mad at each other most of the time, okay? It's time to talk, and one of the first things you need to be doing is saying good things about your spouse. Don't ever say anything bad about your spouse to anybody but God, okay? Don't talk to your friends, your neighbors. Now, God and me, as your counselor or your confessor, maybe I'm the only exception to that, okay? But let me suggest that you find all the good things about your spouse, all both of them, and tell them what you think is good about them. Now, you may be so angry with them that you can't tell them those things right now. So this is my suggestion. Start telling your Heavenly Father those good things about your spouse. It may take you a while to think up the list, but that's okay. Take your time and start telling God, and as you tell the Lord these good things about your spouse, then ask the Lord for the grace to eventually be able to say them out loud in front of your spouse and tell them these good things. You must begin to tell them the good things that you see in them. You've got to be able to start telling each other the good things that you see in each other. Didn't you do that all the time when you were dating? I mean, all you could do is talk about how great it was and how great the other person was, right? Time to get some of that back. Telling them good things is a way to break this cycle of resentment. There's another thing, too, and I call it fighting fair in how you communicate with one another. Because it's okay for you to tell your spouse, you know, that you're doing something that bothers me or disturbs me. And let me give you a framework to use to do that. Use this phrase. When you do blank, it makes me feel blank. When you don't clean the kitchen, it makes me feel like you don't love me. When you leave your socks in the middle of the floor, it makes me feel like you don't care about the house. You understand what I'm saying? When you do blank, it makes me feel blank. You have to say this in a way that's not judgmental, that's not condemning. You have to take as much emotion out of it as you possibly can and make it a statement of fact. Take out of your vocabulary, you never, you always, why can't you ever? Have any of you ever started sentences like that with your wife? You're just like your mother, you always. I mean, you know, this is not how you fight fair in a marriage, okay? The way you fight fair is when you blank, it makes me feel blank. Now, when you start talking that way, you're going to get varying reactions from your spouse. One of them is going to be, no, you don't. You don't feel that way. You couldn't possibly feel that way because that's not what I intended. And, you know, you may have to say this for 6 months before they ever believe that that's what you feel. This is one of the tricks about fighting fair is you got to get to the place when your spouse tells you, when you do this, it makes me feel this. You need to believe them, okay? Because you can't do it because you're manipulating each other, trying to get one up or trying to win the argument. This is not about that. Use that framework and believe me, it'll help you in your communications because we're trying to get out from under the resentment, see? We're trying to get out from under the hostilities. A third way to get out from under the hostilities is to break the cycle of tit for tat. And I'm going to define tit for tat this morning as trying to manipulate your spouse by hurting them because they hurt you. Now, I know that nobody in this parish has ever done anything like that. Your spouse says something nasty to you, and I'm sure you have never responded with something nasty back. But for those listening on the radio, you know, maybe having trouble with tit for tat, tit for tat can also be defined as not showing sympathy or concern because they have not shown sympathy or concern. In other words, you've been hurt, they didn't care. Okay, when you're hurt, I'm not going to care. And you got to break that cycle of tit for tat. Let's use a child again as an example. When your kid has a boo-boo, if you acknowledge that boo-boo, oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I see that. Yes. Oh, there's almost blood there. Let me kiss it and make it better. When you do that, in 20 seconds, the kid's okay and back to playing, right? When you don't acknowledge the boo-boo, when you ignore them or, oh, don't worry about that, that's nothing, they're going to limp around and whimper for an hour, right? I mean, this is the way we are. If you withhold sympathy from your spouse for whatever reason, you know, maybe they're being immature. You're being an immature baby, and so I'm not going to sympathize. Or they're trying to get their way, or they're just trying to get to me. Whatever the reason is, you think by withholding sympathy, somehow that's going to shorten the symptoms, but it's just like the kid with the boo-boo, it's really just going to prolong things. All of us need to feel like we're loved, like we're respected, we're needed, we're wanted, and when you get to phase two of the marriage, you tend to withhold those kinds of affirmations to your spouse, the affirmations they need the most. I mean, we're too hurt to care about them. We can't risk giving them the upper hand, right? You can't risk giving them control. I don't want to encourage them to act like a baby that way. Whatever the reason is, we got our reasons for not giving them sympathy. When we decide to withhold from our spouse that which they need the most from us, then we're just wounding them in the process, and we're prolonging the agony. And in the process, of course, we're prolonging our own agony. Now, it's possible that they have a wound that needs some affirmation. They want you to kiss the boo-boo, and like you say, after 4 or 5 years, it's still there. What that means is they need some inner healing. But by you ignoring it, it's just going to make it harder for them to get that inner healing. And next Sunday, we're going to talk about inner healing and how that works in helping renew marriages. If you keep up the tit for tat, phase two will last forever, and you don't want that. Somebody, preferably both of you, have to start by laying down the hatchet, and difficult and painful as it may be, you have to start to let your spouse know that they are important to you, that what they do is important to you, that you respect them, that you admire them, that it hurts you to see them hurting, that you sympathize with them and with the pain that they're going through, that you love them, that you need them. All of these are things that somebody's going to have to start doing. And yes, I know that their behavior hurts you and it's wounded you, but somebody's got to be mature enough to set aside the hurts and tend to the other person's hurt. Man, husband, you're the head of the house. Act like it. Be mature enough to break the cycle and start treating your wife in a sweet way. Women, you're the nurturers of the family. Act like a nurturer, okay? Nurture your husband. I don't care how immature he's being to you, okay? At first, it may seem like you're giving in to their sympathy, right? And you're just making things worse. But be patient. Just give it some time. Maybe a few years. But if you don't, it's just going to keep lasting longer anyway. Now, the fourth suggestion I have for getting out from under the resentments and the hostilities is see them through the eyes of Jesus. Or how about this? See them the way you want God to see you. Isn't that kind of the same thing? Once upon a time, Debbie had done something wrong to me, and she actually recognized it. And so she asked for forgiveness, but I was still hurt. And so I wasn't sure I wanted to forgive her. I sure didn't feel like forgiving her, I can tell you that. And so I'm praying about something else, and all of a sudden the Lord started reminding me of a whole bunch of things He had forgiven me for, things that were a lot worse than what Debbie had done to me. And I mean, it broke my heart. And all of a sudden I realized, how in the world can I withhold forgiveness from Debbie when the Lord has forgiven me of so many things? Matter of fact, how can I expect God to forgive me if I'm not willing to forgive her? Let me give you a story of seeing somebody the way Jesus sees them, okay? Now, again, I'll use me and Debbie. Once upon a time, Debbie was having a very difficult time keeping the kitchen clean. I was working for a living. Debbie was at home all the time. I'd come home, kitchen be piled high. And it really upset me. And I was doing the standard things. She does that because she doesn't love me. She does that because she's lazy. And if she recognized me as the head of the house, she'd keep the kitchen clean. You know, all these things that you say. But eventually, I began to pray for her about this, that the Lord would somehow help her with cleaning the kitchen. And as I prayed for her, the Lord opened my eyes, and I saw a picture of Debbie, and she was pinned down on the floor with this big old demon. And here she was crying, and she was struggling, and she was scratching on the floor trying to get to the kitchen so she could clean the kitchen, but she couldn't do it. You see, while that demon was hindering her from doing what she wanted to do, there was another lying spirit that was talking to me, telling me all the wrong reasons of why she wasn't doing what I thought she ought to be doing. I had believed a lie. But once I saw through the Spirit of God how the Lord saw things, all of a sudden it made a big difference, and I was able to pray and act differently. And so my question to you is, what lies have you believed about your spouse? The only way you'll ever know is to spend some quality time in prayer related to your beloved spouse. You need to pray for them. Pray about them. God hadn't given up on them. God's not mad at them. God's not angry with them. God's not disappointed with them. You shouldn't be either. Care enough to ask the Lord to show you the way He sees them, and I can tell you, one instant of that kind of revelation will revolutionize a marriage. Whatever you do during phase two, all of these things that I've been talking about, stop the tit-for-tat cycle, say good things about each other, see them the way the Lord sees them, don't take in the wrongs in the first place. Whatever you do, do it because it's the right thing to do. Don't do it because you're trying to manipulate your spouse, because you're trying to get on their good side. Don't do it because you're trying to get back at them for something. Don't do it because you're trying to show them the right way to do things. Just do it because it's the right thing to do. Take care of cleaning up your own house first to make sure you're doing what's right in God's eyes, and then be patient enough, maybe real patient enough, so that they can get around to doing the same thing. You do what I tell you, and you get your first love back. See, during phase two, that's one of the things that begins to happen, is the first love goes. Sometimes the first, the second, and the third love seem to go, and folks are saying, I don't love this person anymore. I don't see how I can ever get back to loving them again. And I want to give you a little hint in restoring first love, okay? I want to tell you about two principles that you need to understand. Because if you think that your first love is gone and will never come back, then you have believed at least one lie, maybe two. The first thing is that love is a conscious decision that you make about who you are. I know that's contrary to everything you see in the media and in our society, but love is a conscious decision that you make about who you are. It's not how you react to somebody. It's not how somebody else makes you feel. It's not how you feel towards somebody. You've seen the scene, single guy walks into a room, there's a beautiful woman in the room, and he looks at her and says, I'm in love. Right? In other words, it's a response. He's not in love, of course, he's in lust at that point. But folks talk about, oh, they just make me feel so wonderful, that's why I love them. That's not what love is. True love, the God kind of love, comes from the inside of you. It's the kind of person that you are, and it's how you've decided to look at and how you've decided to treat people around you. The question is, are you going to treat people with love or not? And it has nothing to do with how they react to you, has nothing to do with how nice they are, how good they are. Can you imagine with God that God was only going to love us if we deserved it or if we were worthy? He'd never love any of us, but He loves us anyway. How about whether or not we loved Him back? Shoot, most of us, when we didn't have a clue who God was, He was still loving us. How about God's only going to love us if we treat Him right in the first place, or we love Him first? Well, that's never going to work. You see what I'm talking about the God kind of love? It has nothing to do with the reaction or the other person. It's everything to do about your state of being, and you have to choose to be love or to not be love. And so the first thing is that love is a choice that you make. It's a decision that you make about who you are. And then the second thing about getting your first love back is that almost certainly it's not gone. It's still there. You haven't lost your first love. It feels like you've lost it, but it's almost certainly there. Now, resentment and hostility, immaturity, all these kind of things have covered it up. And if you can identify all that junk and clean it off, then you'll probably discover that love's still there. It's sort of like if you had a precious gemstone and you dropped it in a pigsty. You'd have to start cleaning away all that muck, and eventually, all of a sudden, you'd find that gem, you'd clean it off, and it'd still be there, just as pretty and precious as it ever was. That's the way it is, oftentimes, with our love in a marriage, is it gets covered up by resentment and hostility. Let me tell you a story about that, and I'll conclude with this. Once upon a time, I'll just leave the details like that, there was a couple that met, and almost instantly, they fell in love. I mean, they had so much in common. They loved talking with each other. They loved being with each other. They loved doing the same things. They were soulmates. They were certain that they should live together for the rest of their lives, and it would be wonderful. And so they got married. And after a while, they got into phase two of their marriage. And after they'd been married about 5 years, they were so frustrated, so upset, were so certain they had lost their first love, that what they did, they both used computers on a fairly regular basis, and they both started going to chat rooms. Not together, but, you know, separately. Separate rooms of the house. And pretty soon, each of them met somebody else in a chat room. And the person that they were chatting with was just seemed to understand them so well, and they had so much in common with that person. I mean, it was just like when they had first met, only now it's with somebody else in chat room. And so they're certain this marriage isn't going to last, and so they start thinking, well, you know, it won't hurt to have an affair. Maybe I can meet this other person, and then I can divorce this clown that I'm with and marry this other person, and then I can live happily ever after. And so each of them set up a date with their chat room person that they have met. And each of them decide they're going to do it out of town so they can't get caught. And so they tell their spouse, I'm going to be gone on a business trip. And it turns out that they're going to do it exactly the same day. And so it's pretty convenient they're both gone on business, right? Each of them has set up their date, their rendezvous, at a restaurant. And when they walk in the restaurant, guess who they see? They see each other. And their first reaction is, how dare you, running around on me, you're trying to have an affair on me, what an awful person you are, I want to get her divorced, I can't live with somebody like that that's going to trifle me. And yeah. Well, after a couple of days, you know, after they'd slept a couple of days, they got to thinking about it, and they came to each other and said, you know, we're still the same people that we were. We're still the same soulmates that we always were. It's just that something has covered that up. And something has gotten in between the real us and in our relationship. And in most cases, it's hostility and resentment. A lot of times, immaturity, wounds that we have. And we'll talk some more about those next week.